Good morning. Good to see you all. This morning, as you noticed, I'm sure, here in the front, we're prepared to celebrate communion together, what is also commonly known as the Lord's Supper. And in preparation for that, I'd like to run through the story of the Lord's Supper. And in the midst of doing so, I want to make two suggestions along the way, especially as we get to the New Testament portion of the story. And then afterwards, I'd like to make two applications of the story to our own lives as we enter into celebrating it together. The story of the Lord's Supper begins 3,500 years ago, approximately. In a faraway land, halfway around the world, in a country called Egypt. And in that particular nation, it really was an empire at the time, we find in the book of Exodus, in the Old Testament, that the Israelites, having congregated, really, in that land of Egypt, through the result of a famine that had occurred in the ancient Near East, were living there in Egypt and came upon a very kind of just a very difficult situation. And that situation was one where they were multiplying, populating, they were having more babies than the Egyptians were and becoming a very large group of people in Egypt. And so the king of Egypt, recognizing this, also recognized that there was a possibility that eventually the Israelites would revolt against the Egyptians. And so the Egyptians put the Israelites into slavery, into bondage, and oppressed them, made them build buildings and all sorts of, you know, sort of civil projects that wore them down. And rather than there being a free people within that empire, they became abject slaves. Well, they had God as their God, and they cried out to God and begged Him to deliver them from their slavery. And we find out in Acts chapter 3 that God hears their prayer. And He hearkens to them, as it might be said in the King James Version. And He remembers the covenant that He had made with Abraham, where He had promised that not only would Abraham have descendants, but also that those descendants would eventually be placed into a land, the land of Canaan, and God would give them that land. But they're in Egypt, and they're in slavery. And so God remembers the covenant that He makes with Abraham, and He decides at that point to deliver and rescue His people from Egypt. The method that He uses to rescue them is by calling upon one man to lead them out of Egypt, and that man is Moses. God appears to Moses in a burning bush. I'm sure you're familiar with that story. And says to Moses, "You're my man. I want you," and this is out in the wilderness of the Sinai Desert, "I want you to go back to Egypt and lead my people out of Egypt. I want you to go to the Pharaoh, to the king, and tell him that Yahweh is delivering his people, the Israelites, from him. Let them go that they might be rescued from slavery." Well, in this conversation with God that Moses has, Moses complains and objects and says, "You know, I'm really not the right guy." And God basically has to try to convince him that he really is the one person that he wants to go. And He tells Moses, too, that what he's going to do is he's going to harden Pharaoh's heart. God is going to do so. God is going to make it difficult for the Israelites to escape, that He's going to cause Pharaoh to reject the very notion that he should let the people go. So Moses says, "Well, you know, in that case, basically, how am I going to convince this guy to let the Israelites go?" And God says, "I'll perform miracles, signs, that some of them in and of themselves will bring hardship upon the Egyptians. And eventually, he will let my people go. And that's the way the story unfolds. And I'm sure that you know about the Nile turning into blood, frogs infesting the land, locusts overrunning the land, cattle dying, all sorts of what we call plagues occurring in Egypt. And Pharaoh will relent and then take it all back. Once the plague is stayed by God, as Moses cries out to God, Pharaoh changes his mind along the way and says, no, you know what? I really am not going to let the people go. So God says, all right, one last time, one last plague, and I guarantee you, Moses, this guy is going to let my people go. And that particular last plague is one where God says, at midnight, I'm going to pass through the land, and I will kill every firstborn within the land. Every firstborn child, every firstborn cattle, there will be devastation. And so, God then goes on to say that this particular time, I want you Israelites to do something special. I want you to take either a one-year-old sheep or a one-year-old goat, and I want you to kill that goat or sheep in the evening, just as the sun is going down. And I want you to take some of the blood of that sheep or goat and put it, kind of spread it, you know, they took hyssop, this kind of this little plant, dip it in the blood of the sheep that you're killing, that you're slaughtering, and I want you to place that blood on the doorposts of the doors of your houses, as well as on the lintel, which is the top of the frame of the door. And that blood is going to be there for a very specific purpose. Because at midnight, when I pass through the land, and I enter in, God is saying, to every household and kill the firstborn, child and cattle, when I see the blood on the lintels and the doorposts of your houses, I will pass over your houses and you will be exempt from the destruction that I am about to create there in Egypt. And this is exactly what happens. So that at midnight, one other little key detail here. In addition to they're slaughtering this lamb and eating it, and they're to eat the whole thing, okay? They can't leave any of it for the next morning because that they're going to be leaving Egypt. God says, I also want you to eat unleavened bread. And the whole purpose for that unleavened bread is a little bit mysterious, except we find out in Deuteronomy 16, where this is all sort of repeated, that the unleavened bread is there apparently to signify that they are, number one, people who are being afflicted. They're oppressed because they're enslaved. And number two, the best way to get away from affliction, or the best manner to get away from affliction is quickly. When you bake bread and you put leaven into the bread, you have to wait for the leaven to have its effect so that the bread will rise. If you're going to make bread that's not leavened, you're not going to put any leaven in it, you can bake it much more quickly and then do whatever what you're going to do afterwards. And that apparently seems to be the point, that they were going to be leaving Egypt in haste. So, to signify that, don't eat leavened bread, instead eat unleavened bread. And so that is what they do. They eat unleavened bread, they slaughter their one-year-old male or goat, they eat that, all of it, and then at midnight, the angel of death passes through Egypt and kills the firstborn in every household except those of the Israelites. And there's this one statement that I just wanted to read to you from the middle of that particular story in Exodus 12, verse 30. And Pharaoh rose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians. And there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was no home where there was not someone dead. Can you imagine that kind of situation? Imagine if that were the United States of America. There was a great cry in America because there was no home where there was not someone dead. That's what God did there in Egypt, saving the Israelites from that death, as well as then from their oppression and their slavery in Egypt. But that's not the whole story, because the Lord's Supper continues the story of it in the fact that God said, this particular event where I'm rescuing you from Egypt is going to be within the very first month of your calendar year. That's one of the ways that you're supposed to remember this. It's the month Abib, March or April. That's like our January. And God says, here's what I want you to do throughout all of your generations. Every year, on the 10th of that month, you are to take, you Israelites, even when you're back in the land, you're to take a one-year-old male, goat or sheep, and you're to just set it apart. And then 4 days later, on the 14th of that month, I want you to sacrifice and slaughter that lamb at evening. Then roast the lamb. Don't boil it. Don't eat it raw. You're to roast that lamb and eat it. And along with it, you're to have unleavened bread. In fact, you're to take all the leaven out of your houses starting on the 14th of that month. And there shall be no leaven in your houses for 7 days until the 21st or after the 21st. So that the 14th and the 21st of the month of Abib then become days where they do no work but simply celebrate. And when their sons and daughters ask them, what does this mean that we're killing this lamb and eating it and eating unleavened bread? The fathers and the mothers are to say to their children, this is to commemorate your ancestors being rescued from slavery in Egypt. And you're to do this once a year, every year. In addition, you're to do it in the place where I choose to place my name. And eventually we find in the history of Israel that God placed his name in the city of Jerusalem, and specifically right within the temple that eventually Solomon built. And then that one was destroyed and some others were built too. So all put all this together, and what God is saying is that once a year, I want you to celebrate the Passover by killing a sheep, eating unleavened bread, and doing it in Jerusalem. Well, what did the Israelites do? For the most part, for the next 1,500 years, this would have been 1,500 BC, they did just exactly that. Then the story of the Lord's Supper continues in Luke chapter 22, where we find out that Jesus, our Messiah, our King, is looking at death himself, because that was part of the purpose for his coming as God and being a man and dying for our sins. And it turns out that the 14th day of the month of Abib, this particular time, as Jesus is approaching his own death through crucifixion, lands on the day before the Sabbath is going to begin. So that would be Thursday. The Sabbath begins at evening on a Friday and runs through a Saturday. And so we find out in Luke chapter 22 that Jesus wants to celebrate the Passover with his apostles, with his disciples, his 12 disciples. And so he says to a couple of them, I want you to go into town. He's outside of Jerusalem. I want you to go into Jerusalem, and you'll see a man who's carrying a pitcher of water, and you're to approach him, and you're to say, our master wants to eat the Passover with us in the room that you have prepared for him. And so this man leads him to his house, and there's an upper room. In that room, he sets up for Jesus and his disciples to eat the Passover. So they, apparently, take a lamb somehow, they've acquired one, to the temple. They sacrifice that lamb as according to the commandment that God gave to Israel back in Exodus and Deuteronomy. And then they take the roasted portion of that lamb, now that it's been sacrificed, back to the upper room. And they eat it as their Passover. In the midst of that, though, Jesus says to them, as he takes the bread, and that's curious to me, because I'm not exactly sure why he uses bread when he does this. But he takes the bread and he breaks it. And he says, do this in remembrance of me. Because what I would have expected him to do is to take the lamb that has been roasted and say, this, because he not only says, you know, take this, do this in remembrance of me, but he says, take this, this is my body. Do this in remembrance of me. Well, why not the lamb, Jesus? I would have figured that you would have taken the lamb instead of the bread. Because we even find out from what Dave taught us last month that when John the Baptist sees Jesus approaching him, as it's recorded for us in John chapter 1, what does John say? Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. John had acquired this understanding that Jesus was trying to teach his disciples that this Passover was going to take on a different meaning, a special meaning for them. And so, but he takes the bread and not the lamb. And I don't know why, but you know, I'll ask him one of these days. We get to heaven, I'll say, you know, could you explain to me? Now, I've got one theory would be that because the bread is called, the unleavened bread, the bread of affliction, or it could even almost be called the bread of suffering, that's really the reason why he takes the bread. But didn't the lamb suffer too when he was slaughtered and roasted? I don't know. So yes, he was. But that's something in any event, Jesus takes the bread. Do this in remembrance of me. This is my body. Then he takes a cup of wine, and he does exactly the same thing with it. But he says, in this case, this is the blood of the new covenant. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. So Jesus is eating the Passover, but he's changing the meaning of it and encouraging his apostles to look at it a different way. But here's my first suggestion. My first suggestion is that we really look at that story within its own historical context. That when Jesus says to his apostles, this is my body, do this in remembrance of me, the question is, what is the this? And my suggestion to you would be that the this is the Passover. That what Jesus is saying is that whenever you celebrate the Passover, which is once a year in the city of Jerusalem, because that's where God had chosen to place his name, he's saying, I want you to think of it differently. That it is not just the Passover that you're celebrating, the escape of the Israelites from Egypt 1,500 years earlier, but you're celebrating your own escape from sin and slavery to sin, and the justice of God whenever you celebrate the Passover. Now, I'm sure that you all are aware of the fact that the church, over the last 2,000 years or so, has typically looked at Jesus' words there and said that Jesus there is instituting the Lord's Supper for the church. That when he says to his apostles, do this in remembrance of me, he's saying, I want you to do this meal maybe even once a week, and I want you to do it in remembrance of me within the context of the church. But as I'm suggesting, I don't think that that's what Jesus is doing there. What he's doing is simply saying that every time you celebrate the Passover, I want you to understand that it could have a new meaning for you as Jews, because if you really understand who I am and what I'm all about. Now, you're also probably aware of the fact that there are at least four different views of communion and the Lord's Supper within Christianity that have existed over the last 2,000 years. You have, for example, the Roman Catholic view, which also is the same as the Eastern Orthodox view. Where that view is that when we eat the bread and we drink the cup, that we are eating and drinking literally the body, would it be that way? The body and blood of Jesus. This is the fancy word that theologians like to call transubstantiation, that the substance of the material is being transformed into the literal body and blood of Jesus Christ. That's Roman Catholicism. The Protestant Reformation came along 500 years ago, and Martin Luther had a slightly different view. It wasn't transubstantiation, it was consubstantiation. Con is the Latin prefix with. It's not that the elements were transformed into anything different, it's just that Jesus is with the elements, not necessarily in the elements, but just with the elements. At that same time, you had John Calvin, and Calvin had a slightly different view, where it wasn't transubstantiation or consubstantiation. There really is no name for his particular view, but he just saw it really pretty much as what he called a means of grace, that every time one celebrated the Lord's Supper, that you basically opened yourself up, like attaching yourself by a wire to God, and God would transmit grace into you as you went through this particular ceremony and celebration of the Lord's Supper. And that was what sometimes is called the Reformed view, this means of grace. Then you had another reformer who lived at that time, who was Ulrich Zwingli. And Zwingli had a completely different view from that, where he saw the celebration of the Lord's Supper as something strictly symbolic. That's all. Not transubstantiation, not consubstantiation, not even a means of grace. It was just something that people did as a symbol of what Jesus did. Now, I mention that to you because oftentimes one hears, when you hear different views, well, we need to stick with the Orthodox view of this particular doctrine or this particular issue that we're talking about. But the question is which Orthodoxy? Whose orthodoxy should it be? Now, we're all Protestants, right? So we can rule out the Roman Catholic orthodoxy right away and the Eastern Orthodoxy right away just because we call ourselves Protestants. But with which Protestant orthodoxy do we go with? Do we go with Luther's? Do we go with Calvin's? Or do we go with Zwingli's? How do we answer that question? Well, we come back to what I am encouraging us to think about more and more. That the argument for anything from tradition or orthodoxy is not a valid argument. The only source that we should use to discuss with one another and seek to come to a conclusion about what the true and right view is of anything in the Bible is the Bible. That's where we go. It's not that we can't use Luther and his commentaries on this subject to think about and talk about, or Calvin's for that matter, or Zwingli's. But they're not our authorities. Our authority is the Bible. That's where we need to go for our source. And by the way, just kind of to add to this whole story, to give you a little more history on this whole thing, this particular issue of the Lord's Supper is what was so divisive for Luther and Calvin and Zwingli, that it's at what is called the Colloquy of Marburg in 1529, the only time that those three great men got together to discuss theology, they came to this particular subject of the Lord's Supper, and they had virtually violent disagreements with one another. In fact, the story goes that Luther had the floor, was standing at the podium, and he is banging on the podium in repeating the Latin from the Vulgate, hoc est corpus meum. And Calvin and Zwingli are sitting there in the audience, maybe as just much as some of you were right there, and going, is this guy nuts? Hoc est corpus meum. This is my body. Claiming that consubstantiation is the correct view. Calvin said, I disagree. Zurich said, I disagree. They left and never communicated with one another again. There's orthodoxy for you. So my suggestion is that, at least at this part of the story, the Lord's Supper, we still haven't found a place where the Bible is saying, this is something that Christians must do on a regular basis. So we go to the next part of the story, and that's in 1 Corinthians 11. And in 1 Corinthians 11, we have a description of a problem in the church of Corinth. That problem was that when the people gathered together to celebrate the Lord's Supper, that instead of treating one another kindly, they were hoarding food and getting drunk. That's a little bit problematic. And so Paul says to the Corinthians, I'd like to praise you on this issue, but I can't, because you are completely mistreating one another. Now, Paul does go on then to quote from Luke chapter 22, where he says, you know, I told you about what Jesus did the night that he was betrayed. You've heard the words over and over again. And I've almost memorized them. That when Jesus said, he broke the bread and he said, this is my body. Do this in remembrance of me. And in the same way, he took the cup after supper, saying, this is the cup which of the new covenant of my blood. Do this also as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. And then he goes on to say, for as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. That is to say that what you're doing here, my friends, Corinthians, is that you're preaching the gospel. Does it make sense to preach the gospel by being stingy and selfish and narcissistic and greedy? Does it make sense to preach the gospel by getting drunk? No, that doesn't make any sense at all. You're proclaiming the Lord's death until he comes. So what he's encouraging them to do is to celebrate the Lord's Supper in a moral manner, basically in a loving manner. When you get together, share your food with one another. When you get together, don't drink too much wine. That's just going to make you drunk, and we're not supposed to get drunk as Christians. I want you to treat each other in a moral and loving manner. Okay, now, here's the second suggestion that I want to make in this story of the Lord's Supper. The suggestion is to look at this story within its context too. What we find out in chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians is that the Corinthians had written to the Apostle Paul and said, we've got some questions for you about certain issues. And Paul then, chapter 7, verse 1, now concerning the things about which you wrote. And then he begins to address the questions that they had. We find out in chapter 8 of 1 Corinthians, verse 1, now concerning things sacrificed to idols. And then we find out in chapter 12 of 1 Corinthians, verse 1, now concerning spiritual gifts, brethren. What I would suggest is that this description and addressing of this problem with respect to the Lord's Supper here in 1 Corinthians 11 is the tail end of the section that begins in chapter 8. Now, concerning things sacrificed to idols. And what Paul does in this section, for the most part, is tell the Corinthians that they have the right to eat meat that's been sacrificed to idols, but they need to do it in a loving manner. Because, you see, in Corinth, there were lots of temples there. The prominent one was probably the temple to the god Apollo of the Greek pantheon. But another prominent one was the temple to Aphrodite, who's the goddess of sex and fertility. And what was common within that society and with that culture was that the people would go to the temples of these various gods, and they would eat a meal in celebration of that god as a means to identify with the god as well as to worship the god. And so they were used to going to the temple of Aphrodite, drinking wine and eating meat, but I can bet you dollars a donuts, in fact, we've got pretty good evidence to this fact, that they were doing it in a rather bacchanalian and meretricious manner. With me? Okay. I want you to learn those two words. They're important here. Bacchus was what? Was who? The god of wine, the god of revelry, the god of drunkenness. Meretricious means to act like a prostitute. Because the temples in the Greek day had temple prostitutes. So when you went to a temple to eat a meal in celebration of your worship of that god or goddess, you also, if you happen to have that particular urge, would engage in sexual work, or what's the word? I can't even think here at this moment. I'm trying to do this in as gracious and yet you had sex with a prostitute, okay? We'll just get to the bottom line here. All right. So, what I suggest Paul does, because these people in Corinth are used to celebrating, eating a meal with both wine and food in celebration and worship of their gods, and they became Christians, and they're saying, you mean we can't, no more meals? I mean, okay, I understand I'm not supposed to get drunk. I understand I'm not supposed to have sex with a prostitute, but this is just part of the fabric of our culture, Paul. And I think what Paul did was this, all right, if a religious meal where you celebrate and worship your God is just part of what you're used to doing, let me tell you about what Jesus did. He had a meal with his apostles. And so let's have you here in the Corinthian culture continue to enjoy a meal with one another within the house churches there in Corinth, and we won't call it Aphrodite's meal, we won't call it Apollo's meal or supper, we'll call it the Lord's Supper. And so you will still have the opportunity then to celebrate a meal with one another in worship with each other within your house churches. I would suggest that that is actually what's going on here in 1 Corinthians 11. So then, we get to the application. The application, I think, of a passage like this would be like, is this. We need to ask the question, in our culture, are there temples where people go to celebrate in a bacchanalian and meretricious manner the worship of their gods or goddesses, where that's just part of the fabric of our society, so that if we become Christians and we want to continue to have that be a part of the way that we just do life, that then Paul could say the same thing to us. Well, you know, Jesus actually had a meal too. It was called the Passover, but let's say that you do the same thing and use that as part of the way that you worship God. And the answer to the question is, do we have that within the fabric of our society? Temples where we go and do that is what? No. No? Okay. Imagine my life. Oh boy, I didn't really mean to say it that way, but oh well. A little bit of disclosure here, okay? My life before I became a Christian, going to bars, sipping wine in a bacchanalian way, hoping that in the midst of worshiping my God, whatever it was, myself, the material things, that I also would have the opportunity to go to bed with a prostitute, some other person of the opposite sex who was there for the same purpose, to worship her God in a bacchanalian and meretricious way. Indeed, that is still part of the fabric of our society and our culture too. Bars are our temples. Loose women are our prostitutes. Loose men are our prostitutes, because they were male and female prostitutes in Greece also. And drinking too much alcohol is just simply the way that we engage in this kind of worship. So indeed, it's part of our society. I become a Christian. I really like going to bars. I like the intimacy. I like the fellowship. I like the relating to people that goes along with that. And now are you telling me now that I can't do anything like that? No. Let's get together as Christians and let's have a meal with one another. It could even be with wine. But let's not drink too much wine and get drunk. And let's not sleep around with each other within the Christian community the way that they would have with the prostitutes in Greece, or the way we do in our bars here in our society. But let's treat each other with kindness and grace and mercy and love and morality. And we'll call that the Lord's Supper. I think that would be the application. Especially when you look in 1 Corinthians 11, and I think it's fairly clear that that was a meal, full-blown, a complete meal. And in addition to that meal, they sang, they prayed, and they looked at the Scriptures. But I think there's also one more application to a passage like this. That if you look at, go back to this verse that I read in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 26, "For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." The question I want to ask is it only when we celebrate the Lord's Supper that we proclaim Jesus' death until he comes? No. Our whole lives are intended to be such. So that's why I think the ultimate, complete application of a passage like this is to look at it and not focus on the ritual where we would take bread and take wine and eat and drink those. But we focus on the problem, really, that Paul points out in this passage in 1 Corinthians 11. And that problem was people were not loving each other well. And then ask ourselves the question, or I'll ask myself the question, how am I treating you? How am I treating my wife? How am I treating my children? How am I treating my neighbor? How am I treating my coworkers? How am I treating other people in this world, outside of even that circle? With the way that I am behaving towards others, could someone say that I truly am proclaiming the Lord's death? Or have I turned Jesus' cross into a mockery because of my anger, my lack of forgiveness, my impatience, my selfishness, my immorality, my sexual immorality, my drunkenness? Have I turned Jesus' cross into a mockery? So it's not just this that we use to proclaim the Lord's death. It is our whole lives, I think, that are intended to be the Lord's Supper.